The greatest achievements of men were at first nothing but dreams in the minds of men who knew that dreams are the seedlings of all achievements. A burning desire to be and to do is the starting point from which the dreamer must take off.
In The Science of Personal Achievement, Napoleon Hill gives you the means to kindle the fire of burning desire in your life. These principles of success are a composite of the techniques used by the world's greatest men. They learned these methods through trial and error. Here, you can learn them from a man who researched and organized them at the direction of steel magnate Andrew Carnegie.
I spent more than 20 years in interviewing America's best-known and most successful men. Men like W. Clement Stone, Alexander Graham Bell, William H. Taft, former President of the United States, John Wanamaker, the Philadelphia Merchant King, Woodrow Wilson, former President of the United States, Harvey Firestone, Dr. Frank Crane, F.W. Woolworth, Theodore Roosevelt, former President of the United States.
This program is assembled from a variety of live recordings and radio broadcasts done many years ago by Napoleon Hill. In some of them, the quality reflects their age. You'll hear music and traffic sounds in the background at times. But the strategies they relate are as clear and valid today as they were when he first voiced them. But Napoleon Hill's life is as powerful as his words in proving these principles. He was advisor to presidents, mentor to millions, and the author of several best-selling books, including the classic Think and Grow Rich. Listen, and you'll hear how he rose from poor beginnings to worldwide success. The year was 1883, and the place was a log cabin.
I was born down in the mountains of Virginia, where the section from whence I came was famous for three things: rattlesnakes, Mountain Dew, and revenue officers. I never had a pair of shoes until I was 10 years old. I never saw a railroad train until I was 12. Later on, I discovered why my father named me Napoleon. I have a great uncle, or did have before he died, in Memphis, Tennessee, the name of Napoleon Hill. He was a multimillionaire cotton broker. I think if I stopped right there, you'd know why my father named me Napoleon. We expected that he would leave some of his money to me on account of my having his name. But when the will was read, when I was at the age of 14, he had left out the entire branch of hills from whence I came. And I think that was the greatest favor that anybody ever did me, because I know what happened to the ones that did get the money. Would you mind asking what?
What?
Nothing. Nothing. Well, I, having had no inheritance, had to go to work, and I learned to make my own money. The next best thing that ever happened to me was when I was assigned by Andrew Carnegie to devote 20 years to the building of this philosophy. One of his conditions was that I should earn my own way as I went along without any subsidy from him. I want to tell you right now, I thought that was a disaster. But that was another blessing that came into my life. Having to earn my own way, I soon learned how to do it. And long before Mr. Carnegie died, I didn't need him anymore, financially or otherwise. I could make my own way. Carnegie was very smart in throwing me out on my own like that. He wanted me to learn to apply this philosophy as I went along, to make it work for myself. And he said, a successful philosopher living in a hovel without any money and his shoes not shined and needing a shave is no good example of selling success. If you want to be successful in helping other people to succeed, demonstrate that you can make your own philosophy work. And I think I have done that quite adequately and at all levels. Well, let me tell you the story of how I came to meet Andrew Carnegie. First of all, when I was in my early teens, I wanted to go away to college but didn't have any money. But I made arrangements with the Tazewell Business College to work my way through and took a secretarial course. And when I finished, I looked around and I had an inspiration that has been far-reaching, that has affected millions of people and will affect millions of people, some of them not yet born. I did something that has never been done before nor afterward, as far as I know, in the way of ensuring that I would go to work for the man that I chose. I recognized that if I picked out a very successful, a very prosperous, a very wealthy man and could work for him in close contact as a secretary, that I would appropriate all of his friends and much of his knowledge, and it would be worth a stupendous amount to me. I finally chose General Rufus A. Ayers of Virginia. He owned a railroad, a chain of banks, a chain of sawmills, a chain of coal mines, and in addition to that, he was a senior member of one of the most important law firms in the state of Virginia. And I made up my mind that General Ayers was going to have the great fortune of giving me my first job. And here is how I broke the news to him. I wrote him a letter and I said, "Dear General Ayers, I have just completed a secretarial course at Tazewell Business College, and I know you will be glad to hear that I have chosen you as my first employer, period and paragraph. I am willing to go to work for you under the following conditions. I will work for the first 3 months and pay you a salary of any amount you name per month for that privilege, with the understanding that if at the end of those 3 months you wish to continue my services, you'll pay me that same salary. But meanwhile, you'll allow me to put on the cuff what I'll owe you, and you can take it out of what you owe me if you continue my services. Sincerely, Napoleon Hill." I guess that put him on the spot, didn't it? He didn't answer my letter. He called my father on the telephone. He said, "I want you to send that boy down. I want to look at him." He didn't say anything about employing me. I went down to this huge law office. He got up from his desk and he came around, walked all the way around me 3 or 4 times, never opened his mouth. And then he went back and sat down at his desk and he said, "I wish to ask you just one question. Did you write that letter yourself or did somebody tell you what to write?" I said, "General Ayers, I wrote that letter myself, and I meant every word of it." He said, "That's just what I thought after I looked you over. And you go to work tomorrow morning in the secretarial department at the regular beginning salary. A rather fabulous salary. At least fabulous in those days. $50 a month. But $50 then were $50. Now, $50 is not $50. It's something much less than that. Later on, when my brother and I matriculated at Georgetown University Law School intending to become lawyers, I looked around and made a contract with a magazine to write stories about successful men. Meanwhile, I had become a newspaper man, a cub reporter, and was fairly good at writing even then. Fortunately, I was assigned to Andrew Carnegie, the wealthiest man in the world at that time, and known throughout the world as being the best picker of men. That's how he became successful. He knew how to surround himself with mastermind allies that could do the things that he needed to have done. And nobody, please hear me on this, nobody ever rises above mediocrity who does not learn to use the brains of other people, and sometimes the money of other people, too. We call it OPM and OPB, other people's brains and other people's money. And it takes a combination of the two, believe you me. Well, Andrew Carnegie gave me 3 hours. And when the 3 hours were up, he said, "This interview is just starting. Come on over to the house and we'll take it up after dinner." And I was so glad that he said, "Come on over to the house." If he'd said, "Go over to the hotel and come back tomorrow morning," I'd have been broke because I had just about enough money in my pocket to pay my way back to Washington. After dinner, we went out into the library and he gave me one of the hardest sales talks that I have ever had or ever heard of in my whole life, about the necessity for a new philosophy that would conserve and pass on to the oncoming generations the sum total of what men like he had learned by a lifetime of trial and error method. And he said it was one of the sins of the ages that this knowledge, gained at such a tremendous price by so many men, was buried with their bones when they died. And nobody had ever organized it into a philosophy and made it available to the man of the street. Well, I wondered why Mr. Carnegie was wasting his time on a cub reporter like me, giving me a sales talk like that. It was way beyond my capacity at that time. I was curious, and I kept my ears open and my mouth shut. Meanwhile, he told me what this philosophy would do for the man who organized it, what it would do for oncoming generations, how it would benefit people not yet born. And then he said, now, I've been talking to you about 3 days about this new philosophy. I've told you all that I know about its possibilities and its potentials. I wish to ask you a question which you will please answer with a simple yes or no, but don't answer until you make up your mind which it is. If I commission you to become the author of this philosophy, give you letters of introduction to people whose help you'll need, are you willing to devote 20 years to research, because that's about how long it will take, earning your own way as you go along without any subsidy from me, yes or no? What would you have done if you had been sitting there in front of the richest man in the world with about enough money in your pocket to pay your way back home, who had propositioned you to go to work for 20 years without compensation or without a subsidy? What would you have said? Well, what you have in mind right now is what I had in mind, too. I knew very well that I couldn't do it. Isn't it strange that when you put an unusual opportunity before a person, a new opportunity, the chances are 1,000 to 1 that his mind will jump to the no-can-do part of it immediately, to the negative side. You think of all the reasons in the world why he can't do it. I can think of about 3 right off the bat. First of all, I didn't have enough money to carry me for 20 years. Second place, I didn't have enough education to deal with these successful men that I'd have to deal with all over the United States and in other countries. And in the third place, and this was about the most serious of all, I was not absolutely too sure about the meaning of that word philosophy that Mr. Carnegie had been kicking around for 3 days and nights. So you can imagine what a fantastic thing that was. A young man with very little education sitting in front of this great man who had offered him an opportunity such as never has come to any other author at any time in the civilization of man. No author, as far as I've been able to tell, has ever had the cooperation and the collaboration of over 500 outstanding men to help create a literary work of any sort. That was the kind of an opportunity that was facing me. And here is an important thing I want to call to your attention. I didn't know this at the time, but I learned about it later. After briefing me for 3 days and nights on the potential of this philosophy, on how it could be organized, on what it would do, Mr. Carnegie made up his mind that when he put the question to me, he would allow me only 60 seconds in which to say yes or no. 60 seconds, that's all. I didn't see it, but he's sitting there with a stopwatch behind his desk, timing me. And it took me exactly 29 seconds to make up my mind that I would accept. I had 31 seconds between me and an opportunity such as never come to another author. I have never known of any author in any field having so much help, so much guidance, given and supplied without money and without price. I was ready to go back to Washington, and Mr. Carnegie then did another thing. And if you don't get anything out of your trip except what I'm now about to tell you, it might well change your entire destiny and through you the destiny of many other people. Mr. Carnegie said, well, Napoleon, 20 years is a long time, and I have given you a pretty tough assignment, and you have accepted it. I want to warn you now that you're going to have many temptations along the way, long before you complete your 20 years of research, to quit. Because that's the easiest thing that a weakling can do, is quit. I don't think you're a weakling. If I had thought so, I would not have given you the opportunity. But I do know that you need something to bridge over your temptations to quit if and when they do come. I'm now going to give you a formula that will enable you to condition your mind so thoroughly that nothing in the world can stop you from going ahead and completing the task to which I have assigned you. I was taking all this down in shorthand. He said, I want you to write very slowly, and I want you to underscore every word that I speak now. And here's a message that I want you to repeat to yourself at least twice a day, once just before you go to bed at night and once just after you get up. Looking at yourself in a mirror, you're talking to Napoleon Hill now, mind you. And here's what you say to him. Andrew Carnegie, I'm not only going to equal your achievements in life, but I'm going to challenge you at the post and pass you at the grandstand. And I threw my pencil down. I said, now, Mr. Carnegie, let's be realistic. You know very well I'm not going to be able to do that. At that time, Mr. Carnegie was rated as a billionaire, probably the first and maybe the only billionaire this country has ever created, as far as I know. He said, why, of course I know you're not going to be able to do that unless and until you believe it. But if you believe it, you will. Well, they said, let me ask you to do this. Try it out for 30 days. Will you do that? Well, I said, yes, that's a reasonable request. I certainly will, but I had the fingers on both hands crossed. I knew doggone well it wouldn't work. The idea of a youngster in his early 20s promising to equal and outdo the achievements of a man who had reached the stage of a billionaire. Why, it was so ridiculous, it wasn't even funny. It even scared me. I thought Mr. Carnegie lost his mind. I came very near walking out on him. It was just something that was too good to be true. But I promised. And when I got back to Washington, my brother and I had an apartment. When I went to go over this formula, I didn't want my brother to know what a big fool I'd made of myself, because I had some news to break to him that were not going to be good anyway. I had agreed to pay the expenses of the two of us through school, and I was going to have to tell him that I was dropping out, and he'd have to earn his own way. I went into the bathroom, and I closed the door real tight, and I got real close up to the glass and almost whispered this formula. And as I turned around, in my mind's eye, I saw the real Napoleon Hill standing there, and I says, you darn liar, you know very well you're not going to be able to do that. Only darn is not the word I used. It was a much more definite and stronger word. And I felt like a fool, like a thief, going through a thing like that, a farce. And that's just what it seemed like. But I said, well, after all you promised, Mr. Carnegie, go ahead and try it. Well, for the first week, or just about the first week, I had that attitude of feeling like I was doing something foolish. And then all of a sudden, about the beginning of the second week, something inside of me said, why don't you change your mental attitude about this? Do you realize that Andrew Carnegie is the richest man in the world, that he is known all over the world as the best picker of men in the world, and if he chose you to do a job like this, he must have found something in you that you didn't know was there. Why don't you change your mental attitude? And ladies and gentlemen, I started to change my mental attitude. And if I hadn't have done so, I wouldn't be standing here talking to you today, and I wouldn't be talking to millions of people in this and other countries of the free world through my books if I hadn't changed my mental attitude and become positive instead of negative. I started in to repeat this in earnest. And by the end of the month, I not only believed that I'd catch up with Mr. Carnegie, but I knew that I would excel him. And believe you me when I tell you that I have long since attained that objective. And I'll tell you why I've attained it. Mr. Carnegie made not over 20 or 25 millionaires at the most. The millionaires that I have had the privilege of making, they're legion. They're all over the world. But that's not the main claim for my having outranked Mr. Carnegie. I have brought men and women together in a spirit of understanding that didn't exist. I've helped men and women to find themselves in all walks of life. I have saved men and women from suicide by helping them to find themselves. I have done for the world things that Mr. Carnegie never did do. And not only that, but what I have done has been recorded, it's been tested, it's being taken to a free world. And it's going to benefit millions of people who are not yet born.
Mr. Carnegie gave away most of his money before his death. But he entrusted to me what he said was the greater portion of his riches, which consisted of the means by which he acquired his wealth, and committed me to devote my life to taking this knowledge to the people of the world. It was the one quality without which no person may achieve noteworthy success in any calling, and I may add, it was a quality I did not know I possessed until it was disclosed by the searching mind of the great Andrew Carnegie. It can be acquired by all who master and apply the idea of definiteness of purpose. This quality consists of the habit of turning on more willpower instead of quitting and accepting defeat when one is faced with difficult problems and the going becomes hard. Now, the vast majority, approximately 95% of the people of all countries, go around and around without aim or purpose. They drift with the circumstances of life, good or bad. Whereas the successful individuals create their own circumstances and ride them to victory.
You can write your own success story if you find your own definite purpose. To compose the first chapter, you need to know and implement the seven factors that are part of definiteness of purpose.
The first premise or factor is this. The starting point of all achievements is the adoption of a definite purpose, accompanied by a definite plan for its attainment, followed by an appropriate action. That means plan, purpose, and action. Those three words constitute the first factor. Now, there has never been known to be a success in any calling except as the result of definiteness of purpose. Now, we all have purposes, varying purposes, but they're not definite. Most often, they are hopes and wishes. We all wish for money. We wish for opportunity. We wish for love and affection. We wish for recognition. We wish for a lot of things. But wishing is not just quite enough. Before you can be sure of success, you have to have a definite objective, a definite plan for getting it, and you have to back that plan with everything you have. And you have to treat your mind constantly until the subconscious section of the mind picks up your plan and finds out what it is that you want. The second premise is that all individual achievements are the results of a motive or a combination of motives. Now, you never heard of anybody accomplishing anything in this world or doing anything except as the result of a motive. All sane people move as the result of motives, and there are nine basic motives under which you can classify every impulse that you have to do or not to do throughout life. And here they are. Number one is the emotion of love. Number two is the emotion of sex. And number three is the desire for material wealth. Now, these are known as the big three. And it has been said that these three emotions practically govern the entire world. And I don't think that's an overstatement of the truth by any means. Number four is the desire for self-preservation. Number five is the desire for freedom of body and mind. And number six is the desire for personal expression and recognition. That's an outstanding motive, the desire for personal recognition and expression. And number seven, the desire for perpetuation of life after death. Now, those are the seven positives, and here come the two negatives that influence your lives very often more than the positives, the ones that you have to look out for. Number eight is the desire for revenge. You would be surprised at how much of one's life is devoted to wanting to strike back at somebody for some imaginary or real grievance. And yet all such effort is destructive. And number nine is the grandfather of them all. Guess what that is? Probably influences more human action than all other motives combined. And yet the most destructive of them all. Number nine is the emotion of fear. And under that heading, there are seven basic fears, seven things that you have to be on the lookout for constantly, all the way through life. Number one is the fear of poverty. Now, why anybody should be afraid of poverty in a great nation like this, where opportunity abounds on every hand, is more than I can understand. But I do know that the vast majority of my students have to be treated first for the fear of poverty. They have to be made success conscious, and you'll never be successful in anything until you do become success conscious. You'll have to get over that idea of self-limitation. And the second of the seven basic fears is the fear of criticism. You're lucky indeed if you come this far in life, all of you or any of you, without having suffered from the fear of criticism. The fear of what they'll say. Now, I have heard so many people say, well, I'd do so-and-so if it weren't for what they will say. And I have never yet found out who they were. They are entirely imaginary beings. Yet you'd be surprised how powerful they are. They stupefy enthusiasm. They cut down your personal initiative. They destroy your imagination. And they make it practically impossible for you to accomplish anything above mediocrity. Number four is the fear of ill health. The doctors know too well what that fear does. It results in a condition known as hypochondria, or imaginary illness. And number five is the fear of the loss of love of someone, upon which all of that form of dementia praecox, known as jealousy, is based. Jealousy doesn't require a reason. It can be just as violent and just as destructive where there is no basis for it as where there is a basis. But it is a motivating force and a fear. One of the seven basic fears. Number six is the fear of old age.
I don't know why men and women should be afraid that they're going to dry up and blow away when they get to that nice ripe old age of 40 to 50. The real achievements of the world were the results of men and women who had gone well beyond the age of 50, and the greatest age of achievement was between 65 and 75. So I don't know why one should be afraid of old age, but nevertheless they are. And the last and the grandfather of them all is the fear of death. It's the rarest thing in the world to find a person who hasn't at one time or other been afraid of dying. Now, this course and this philosophy, before you finish with it, will, I hope, prepare you to eliminate all of those seven basic fears, particularly the last one. Now, the third premise is that any dominating idea, plan, or purpose which you hold in your mind through repetition of thought and which is emotionalized with a burning desire for its realization is taken over by the subconscious section of the mind and acted upon through whatever natural and logical means that may be available. In the slang of the day, there is a mouthful in that sentence. Any dominating idea, plan, or purpose held in the mind through repetition of thought and which is emotionalized with a burning desire for its realization is taken over by the subconscious section of the mind and acted upon through whatever natural and logical means that may be available. Now, the key ideas in that sentence is natural and logical means and a burning desire. Well, a burning desire is a desire which prompts you to be willing to give anything in the world, whatever the price may be, in order to attain the object of that desire. A burning desire is one that you take to bed with you at night. You give it over to your subconscious mind at night. You get up with it in the morning. You eat with it. You sleep with it. You first get it, and then it gets you. Now, that's what a burning desire is. You may have to talk about it. You may have to think about it. However, when it comes to talking about it, be careful where you talk, because you may become boresome to somebody. Now, some of these things that I'm going to tell you about may seem fantastic. Some of them you may never have done before. Don't just take a part of this philosophy and apply it. Take it just as I give it to you, and no matter how foolish it may seem to you or to those around you at the beginning, follow it to the letter. The fourth premise is that any dominating desire, plan, or purpose which is backed by that state of mind known as faith is taken over by the subconscious section of the mind and acted upon almost immediately. The fifth premise, the power of thought is the only thing over which any human being has complete, unquestionable control. A fact so astounding that it connotes a close relationship between the mind of man and infinite intelligence. The very fact that the Creator gave man control over only one thing, it was intended that that one thing should be sufficient for the man's needs. And believe you me, it is sufficient if you use it properly. If there isn't anything you can't achieve which you can conceive and believe. If you can conceive an idea, a plan, or a purpose and believe that you can achieve it, you can find out ways and means of doing it. But you have to be definite about it. You have to be specific. You have to know what it is you want. You have to know why you want it. And you have to make up your mind what you're going to give in return for it, because nature frowns upon the idea of something for nothing. And the sixth premise, the subconscious section of the mind appears to be the only doorway of individual approach to infinite intelligence. The basis of the approach is faith, based upon definiteness of purpose. Any idea, plan, or purpose held in the mind in a spirit of faith begins almost immediately to reveal to you ways and means of carrying out that idea. The seventh principle, every brain is both a broadcasting set and a receiving station for the vibrations of thought, a fact which explains the importance of moving with definiteness of purpose instead of drifting, since the brain may be so thoroughly charged with the nature of one's purpose that it will begin to attract the physical or material equivalents of that purpose. That's an astounding thing, ladies and gentlemen, all the more so because it is a provable fact. That is to say that the first broadcasting and receiving set ever built was the brain of man. And whether you recognize it or not, you're constantly tuning in on the vibrations of other people, especially the people with whom you are in harmony. I mean, where your thoughts and their thoughts agree. If your thoughts happen to be of poverty, of failure, of illness, why, you'll tune in the thoughts of all other people who are releasing similar thoughts. If your thoughts are dominatingly controlled by thoughts of success and riches, opulence, you'll be tuning in on the thoughts of all other people who think along those lines. There'll be times when ideas will flash into your mind that's so negative that they almost scare you. You wonder where they came from. You wonder why your mind would hand over to you such destructive thoughts. And if the truth were known, you are just, you've left your receiving set open. You've tuned in on the wrong type of minds. This philosophy is designed to keep your receiving set closed to all except the kind of minds that you want. And those are positive minds. Minds that think in terms of what you want instead of what you don't want. I think one of the strangest things in life consists in this, that most people go all the way through life, regardless of their education or their standing or their opportunity, they go all the way through life as failures. They suffer with fears and limitations, and strictly speaking, they never find happiness. And the reason, if you would examine it, is that they allow their minds to dwell upon failures, poverty, ill health, and the things they don't want. Now, the mind has a peculiar way of attracting to you the things that it feeds upon, things that it associates with. It's like a rotten apple in a barrel, and you can't afford it. You can't afford close association with people who are not vibrating on all 12 cylinders. Pick out the winners. Be like the man who went to the restaurant and ordered lobster, and when they brought him out, he had one of his big claws was gone. He complained about it, and the waiter said, oh, he got in a fight and lost that one. He said, bring me the winner. I want the winner. Now, that's the idea exactly. Associate with winners because they'll do something to you. And if you associate with failures, they'll do something to you in spite of all you can do.